From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Without a doubt, Thai food is one of the world's great cuisines, prized for bringing flavors like sweet, sour, spicy, and salty into perfect balance. But until recently, it wasn't widely seen in the U.S. as very diverse. That's beginning to change with the growing awareness of regional Thai dishes that go well beyond pad Thai and Massaman curry.
You know, I just miss that innocence of eating with your hands and family gatherings and sitting on the floor and, you know, a big bowl of soup. Everyone's double dipping and, you know, it's totally the opposite of what I do at Kumi.
That's Oakland chef James Sihabut. He was born in northeast Thailand and his parents are of Laotian heritage. At the age of 2, James came with his family to the U.S. as refugees in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. Today, he heads up Kumi, a Bay Area Michelin-starred kitchen, but it's the foods of his Lao and Thai heritage that he's sharing in his first cookbook called Hawker Fare, also the name of his Thai Isan eatery in San Francisco. You write that this book, Hawker Fare, is sort of an apology letter. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's just like, about like coming to an age. You know, I kind of disowned my heritage for the longest time. And, you know, it's kind of like a soul-searching memoir and reconcile myself and my past. And it's like, you know, who am I? And the best way for me to understand that was through food. I'm a chef, obviously. So, like, you know, food was the vehicle to kind of trace my past and really find myself. And that's how I got into cooking in the first place was being around Lao food and Thai food that I kind of turned my back on to the world of fine dining. Yeah, which I didn't think about so much until I got older. I'm like, wow, it's a shame that I don't know how to make proper lop and, you know, these chili dips that I grew up on. And I was always around it and surrounded, but I had no interest in it. And now I do. And it's a big part of myself. And now I have 2 children. It's like, what do I pass down to my kids? And I think these, like, recipes, you know, it's like it's people say you are what you eat, but just say you are what you also cook.
When you finally decided to embrace this food culture of yours, was your mother still alive to teach you?
Yes, she's still around. She lives half of the year in Ubon, in northeastern Thailand, and half of the year here with me, actually. And, you know, she has 2 grandchildren now. So, yeah, she comes back and forth. And if she comes, she comes home. She always brings back, you know, some dried leaves from the Khao Su leaves that we make this traditional stew with. That's very, very fantastic. So it's an advantage for sure.
She must have been absolutely delighted when you decided to focus on this food.
My mother's really hard to read. I think when I ask her, I'm like, hey, how do you make this? And I think she was surprised. Like, after all these years, I never asked her in detail about certain dishes or asked her to make certain things. I was kind of go with the flow. And, you know, I was in the world of fine dining for the longest time now and it caught her off guard. It's like, hey, mom, let's jiao ming da, like the water beetle dip. Like, how do you make that? And she was like, why do you have interest in this all of a sudden? After all these years, you see me make it right next to me and all of a sudden you're not around anymore doing your Michelin star dance and and all of a sudden like you're interested in water beetles. It's like, what gives? It's like, yeah, you know, I miss it. Family gatherings and sitting on the floor and, you know, a big bowl of soup. Everyone's double dipping and, you know, it's totally the opposite of what I do at Kumi where everything's precise. You know, no one shares anything and multiple courses and multiple silverware and rarely eat with your hands. I miss that. It's very, very playful. I miss that playfulness in food.
Could you describe what you refer to as the mirrors and walls between Lao and Thai cuisine?
Mirrors and walls. I think the mirrors are some of the dishes that we known as Thai cuisine, like papaya salad. Some research say it originated in Laos, and the Thais adapted it, I don't know for certain, and now there's 2 different versions of it. So it's a mirror, but the wall is like the spice level, the sweetness is not there. Bitter is a big flavor in Lao food, herbaceousness that we're not accustomed to in Thai food as we know it. It's definitely a relationship. You know, there's some things travel with the Lao culture into the Isan region, because the Isan region of Thailand, northeastern part, is culturally Lao, but it's part of Thailand. So, you know, for me, I'm kind of stuck in both worlds, you know, and for me, trying to doing this cookbook really made me understand, like, the history of why is the Isan food different from central Thailand, and tracing back migration of people and politics and wars and neocolonialism and all that. It's like made me really understand who I am and how I came to be. So when I tell people, like, hey, you know, what's your story? I just tell people, yeah, I'm a Thai refugee. And they're like, that does not make any sense at all. There's no such thing as Thai refugees. Like, well, I was born in Ubon, which is part of Thailand, but my dad's Lao. I say, I'm born in Ubon. It's like, oh, dude, you're Lao. And you ask somebody else, dude, you're Thai. I was like, why can't I just be both? Because I am. So crazy enough, like, there's a lot of people ever since this book came out have reached out to me in, like, social media. And it's like, oh, my God, we share the exact same story. You know, we came to the United States about the same time, but we landed in Missouri, and we have the same heritage lineage, which is pretty amazing. I didn't, you know, those kind of caught me off guard for sure.
That must be wonderful. So teach us, what are the main components of a Lao Isan meal?
So usually it's spread. There's, in Western food, there's, you know, usually you have your protein, starch, and vegetables. There's always some sort of chili dip on the table, sticky rice, of course. Some ethnicities eat only jasmine rice, but there's always a soup, grilled meats, some steamed vegetables. Maybe there's always some kind of muddled salad, either long beans or papaya, or sometimes cucumbers with vermicelli. And it's quite a simple table, some fried meat, sometimes grilled. And those things all come together. It's not coursed out. So you have a spread of like six dishes.
Including the soup?
Including the soup, yeah. You would like sometimes take a ball of sticky rice, dip into a chili dip, or tear a piece of the grilled meats, dip into the chili dip. There are actually no rules. And that's the most playful part of eating the food. You know, it's a very different approach, a way of eating.
So you just used this really interesting term. You said muddled salads.
Mm-hmm.
So I think most of us are familiar with the role of the mortar and pestle in making a papaya salad, for example. But give me another example of a muddled salad and what you mean by that term, muddled.
Yeah, so muddling is a way of bruising any vegetable. If you do a cucumber, you have a lighter hand to extract the juices. You bruise the vegetable or fruit. And there's an exchange of flavor from the fish sauce into the cucumber juice or liquid from the papaya or carrot. And it creates that dressing, like it naturally dresses itself. And the bruising also gives it like a pleasant texture. It allows it to like macerate. It's just a very, very wonderful way of eating that's still refreshing, but not cooked, but wilted a little bit. But it still has that freshness of, like, flavor of lime juice and, you know, dry chilies or fresh chilies, depending which style of salad you're making. And it's just, like, quite wonderful and easy, very, very easy to do.
You've just made me extraordinarily hungry. So let's talk about a mainstay of the Lao table called lap. Sometimes people call it lab or larb. Could you describe what we mean when we say lap?
Lap, it's truly a term of like a salad that's tossed. Usually it involves protein. Either it's minced meat, chicken, beef, fish. Sometimes it involves offal. And it's just, you know, something that's either lap dip, which is raw beef, like a beef tartare. The ground premise of it gets tossed with like toasted rice powder, dry chili, sometimes fresh. If you're making a goi, which is a subdivision of lap, there's like lemongrass. Some regions put lime juice. Some regions no acid. It gets dressed with fish sauce or padak, which is an unfiltered fish sauce. And then a bouquet of herbs. You know, it could be spring onion tops, shallots, mint, cilantro, rom. It kind of depends like where you are and what you feel like, what grows around you. Then that's kind of the premise of lap. It's really a open-ended kind of category. I've done lap with like cauliflower and tofu. So it's just kind of fun. It's like, you know, like vegetarians should experience lap also. And this was kind of like the segue without really sacrificing the flavors of lap.
A lot of my friends who are most comfortable making Western cuisines at home find it difficult to make the leap to start cooking some Asian foods. Mm-hmm. What dish would you suggest making that would entice them enough to take a leap to a new set of flavors and techniques?
I think like any of the grilled meats, you know, everyone loves barbecue. You know, it's a worldwide phenomenon, like grilled meats and barbecue. You know, there's always the same techniques of making a brine or making a paste, and then you just marinate it and you grill it. I think that's, and then making the condiments. I think those are fairly easy entry way to experience the food, and it always comes out delicious. I mean, who doesn't love barbecue? You know, and one is like sticky rice, you know, or the sticky rice and any of the chili dips, really. The chili dips are fairly easy to do, like the Joe McLean, which is just charred tomatoes with, you know, fish sauce, dried toasted chili flakes, garlic, and shallots, mortar and pestle, and you can make a large batch and just eat that to dip with sticky rice. And that's like, that could be sometimes a meal for my family, you know, it's just like a chili dip and rice, like, and that's it.
I've been talking to James Sihabut about his new book, Hawker Fare. He's the chef and owner of the Thai Isan restaurant by the same name in San Francisco, as well as the 2 Michelin star Komi in Oakland. Coming up, we continue our focus on Thai food with a whirlwind tour of the food of Bangkok. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
So when you evaluate a food that doesn't belong to your culture, you kind of have to set aside the preconceptions of what is considered good or delicious and kind of trick yourself into being reborn into that culture and try to see things through the lens of the people of that culture.
That's writer Leela Bunya Ratapoon. She's a native of Bangkok, but now divides her time between her hometown and Chicago. She started her Thai food blog, shesimmers.com, in 2008 in honor of her mom, who she credits with her love of food and home. This year, Leela published her second cookbook, a culinary love letter to her hometown titled Bangkok, Recipes and Stories from the Heart of Thailand. It's such a beautiful book. And it's interesting because the recipes are different than recipes I've seen in previous Thai books.
Yes, it is. It's mostly because the food of Bangkok is actually different. See, when we talk about Thai food in the West, people think of the menu of Thai restaurants, the same old dishes that you've seen. Those dishes have become the representative of Thai food as we know it in the West. When those things have proven popular, you know, people don't feel the need to change anything, so they keep serving you the same dishes. That doesn't apply to LA, actually. LA is different. LA is its own thing, too.
And I have to ask you, is it just a kind of really homey cooking, or is it really your mom's cooking? Is it a very personal lens?
It's a very diverse collection of recipes. Some of them are homey stuff. Some of them are royal dishes that I've only heard of through old cookbooks that my family collects. And there are historical dishes that are hardly ever made these days anymore. Street dishes that you eat every day from morning to midnight. Dishes that belong to certain enclaves in the city. For example, the Portuguese Thai noodle dish. I would say the collection of recipes in the book is just as diverse as the food of the city.
I love that. And I also have to say that as much as I love the food, as a home cook now who has facility with certain cuisines, some books have really intimidated me. But there's something about your book where some of the recipes seem much more approachable. Like, for example, you say that some like it bouncy, and you're talking about texture.
Correct. I believe that every culture has its own preference when it comes to taste and texture and other things. So when you evaluate a food that doesn't belong to your culture, you kind of have to set aside the preconceptions of what is considered good or delicious and kind of trick yourself into being reborn into that culture and try to see things through the lens of the people of that culture. For example, when I went to Spain for the first time and I had some squid and some octopus there, that restaurant was really famous and everyone told me that I needed to go there, and I had that octopus there. And the first time that I had it, I thought to myself, this was mealy and soft and so tender. It's not good.
I thought
to myself, oh, okay, I'm in Spain. I had to think like a Spanish person. I cannot import my Thai thinking into this context. And when you go to Thailand and you see how squid and how octopus are prepared, if you're not used to that bouncy texture, if you think that you need to braise squid and octopus until they're soft and tender, they're fork tender, you're going to be shocked. And you're going to wonder, like, really? People really like this? And yes, they do. They like bouncy, chewy things. Not everything, but when it comes to something like that, yes.
Take me back to your mom's kitchen in Bangkok. Mm-hmm. What do you remember her making, and what smells do you remember that you've shared with us in the book?
The shrimp paste relish. It's at the core of Bangkok cuisine. It's something that it doesn't matter what family background you come from, or you know what job you do, or whether you're a transplant in the city, or you were born in the city and you've been there for, you know, all your life. Everybody seems to like that shrimp paste relish and fried mackerel. And that is a very distinct representation of the central cuisine. And Bangkok is located in the central region of Thailand.
Is it made with dry shrimp or fermented shrimp?
It's fermented shrimp. Krill, actually, salted and dry and ground and fermented until it turns into dark purple paste that is salty and full of umami and just funky and delicious.
How old were you when you first came?
Well, I came here for school, so it was like mid-20s.
Did you grow up cooking with your mom, or did you come to cooking later when you had to cook for yourself?
I didn't cook as much when I was living with my mom, but I cooked more after I moved to the States out of necessity. Because if I didn't cook it myself, I wouldn't have it. Anything that I wanted to eat, that is.
So in this book, what are a couple things that you put in your rotation that made you feel like home?
The rice vermicelli dishes, there are a few in the book. And the most glorious Thai dish in that book, I would say, is the rice vermicelli with lentil peanut sauce. And this particular peanut sauce is not the kind of peanut sauce that you've seen at most Thai restaurants in the West, not the kind of peanut sauce that is served with satay, but it's the more elaborate, almost like gravy that you ladle over rice vermicelli or khanom tin noodles. And when I think of the best Thai food, I think of that dish.
So one thing that I'm curious about is, you know how in Thai restaurants, if I were to order a rice noodle dish, mm-hmm. then I get asked, what kind of meat do I want in it? Do I want chicken? Do I want shrimp? Do I want pork? Is it really that substitutable in Thailand, or is that an American concession?
The whole, like, choose your protein thing is, I would say it's more of a tradition of the Thai restaurants in the West more than back in Thailand. For example, Pad Thai. When I was growing up, Pad Thai was made with no meat at all. It was just dry shrimp. And you had to tell them to put eggs in it, and then you had to pay extra for the eggs. And then we started having some shrimp, some river prawns added to it for, you know, a few extra baht. I never had pad thai with beef or chicken until I got to the U.S.
Did you like it or did you think it was weird?
I thought it was weird in the beginning. I'm used to it now, and now I like it. And now when I go back to Thailand, I'm like, where's the beef?
That's so funny. So when you started your blog, was the plan to make Thai food approachable for home cooks or more versatility?
Well, originally, it wasn't to do any of that. It was just to create a place where I could put what I have learned from my mom or what I have learned from the cookbooks that she had been sending to me for fear that she would lose me to the American culture.
I love that.
Like, there's nothing to be afraid of. And like, what is wrong with that? But anyway, she has been sending me cookbooks for a long time. I got like over 200 right here. After she died, I wanted to create a place where I could share with people what I had learned from her and from those cookbooks. That was all. And then after about a year, people started requesting recipes, tips, and things like that. And next thing I know, I was sharing things that I never thought that I would, like how to shop for ingredients, where to shop for ingredients, what to look for to get the best quality, how to choose a mortar. Sometimes I would write about things that my mother probably would not approve of, but it's necessary. For example, how to steam sticky rice using the splatter guard, which you don't usually use for that purpose, but it comes in very handy. Traditionally, sticky rice is steamed in a bamboo basket that is set over a pot of water. But it's hard to clean and it's hard to find and not everybody can find it. It's just a lot of work. It's easier to just put that splatter guard on top of a pot of boiling water and just put your sticky rice in there and just steam it. And within like 15 minutes, it's done. People kind of came to me for things like that, tips and, you know, how to MacGyver things. And
I love that. I'm a big proponent of MacGyvering. Your book is absolutely beautiful, and I look forward to cooking from it. Thank you so much, Leela.
Thank you, Evan.
I've been talking to Leela Bunyarutapun, creator of the Thai food blog SheSimmers.com. Her latest cookbook is Bangkok, Recipes and Stories from the Heart of Thailand. Find a recipe for her braised chicken and coconut galangal cream sauce on the Good Food blog. That sounds very delicious. That's blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. And be sure to check out her first book, which is equally wonderful. It's called Simple Thai Food. I can't recommend it enough, especially if you're new to cooking Thai food. And now a visit to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to hear all about one of the most important ingredients in all of Thai cooking.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm visiting with the chef who's visiting our Saturday Farmers Market here in downtown Santa Monica, Katie Nushlaor. She is chef owner of Same Same Thai Restaurant in Silver Lake. Katie, you're a long way from the restaurant,
yes.
And we're so happy to see you here. Tell me
nice
what you're shopping
back.
For.
I'm shopping for lemongrass, fresh lemongrass.
Which I assume is an essential Thai ingredient.
It's the main ingredient for Thai cooking.
Okay, and are you coming here because you just can't find it anywhere else?
You can find it in Thai market, but the farmer's market seems to have the freshest ones.
Okay, and I've seen lemongrass, and it looks sort of like a dried, large scallion in a way. So how do you pick a good one?
Well, it looks very intimidating because this is long, dry stalk. But you pick a good one, you want to pick a firm stalk, and you don't want it to be soft or rubbery because that's a sign of it's being old and not fresh.
So do you use the whole thing?
You don't use the whole thing. When you use lemongrass, you want to cut out the lower bulb because it's the purple part of it. Because it's hard, you don't want to use that part. You also want to take out the tough outer leaves, and you want to use just the inside for soup, curry paste, and everything else.
Okay, and then you're mostly cooking it. It's going to be slow, long cooked. You don't just chop it up and throw it on a salad like a scallion.
No. One of the most popular soup in Thailand is called Tom Yum Kung, and we offer it at Same Same. And we use lemongrass as the main ingredients. So when you prepare the lemongrass, you take out the tough part, the tough leaves, and cut out the bottom bulb. then you pound it, and then you throw it into the stock, and then you simmer the broth combined with kefir lime, galanga, chilies, and coriander. You can add coconut. Uh-huh. It'll turn into a different soup called tom kha. Uh-huh. But if you leave the coconut out, it will be tom yum.
And the stock, is it vegetable stock, chicken stock, water?
Chicken stock.
Oh, chicken stock.
You can do it with water, too. If mm-hmm. people are vegetarian, mm-hmm. we can do water stock.
Mm-hmm. Does the lemongrass taste like lemon?
It has a unique taste to it, flavor to it. It's lemony but sweet.
But not bland. You know, sometimes you get those sweet lemons and limes and they just are bland.
It's very subtle until you cut it or bash it. Mm-hmm. That's when you get all the aroma mm-hmm. and the flavors.
So you really have to beat it up to get it to release its goodness.
Enough. And then you can cook it longer, like for 2 minutes. You want to put in the broth mm-hmm. For 2 minutes for it to soften up and have the aroma to come out.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's an absolute key ingredient, and it must be a challenge for you to get the best lemongrass you can find on a year-round basis.
No, you can get them all year round. It's actually easier to find nowadays, especially in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. You know, what's interesting about lemongrass is you buy the fresh one, you can actually soak it in water, and the roots will grow. Once the roots grow, you can replant them.
Do you do that?
We do it. My cousin, who's a chef, she likes to save them and grow them, regrow them. But it takes a long time to grow it.
Oh, I think it'd be nice to have a little lemongrass planter in your restaurant. That'd be cool.
We do have them.
Oh, you do? Very cool.
We do have them.
Oh, that's amazing. So the soup sounds absolutely delicious. And everybody loves Thai.
Come and try it.
Yeah, we all should. That was chef owner Katie Nuchlaor, and she is with Same Same Thai Restaurant in Silver Lake. I'm talking now with Kong Tao, who's the owner of Tao Family Farm in Fresno. Tao is known for a wide variety of Asian vegetables and very high quality, of course, Kong. And you grow lemongrass. You're the only farmer on Saturday that grows a lemongrass. So tell us about why you grow it. Do you use it yourself?
Lemongrass, we use it for everything we cook at home. We started growing it because that's, you know, what my parents are from Southeast Asia, so that's what they eat. That's what we've always ate. So mm-hmm.
You grew up with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you grow it all year round?
It grows year round. Certain seasons, like when it's cold, it doesn't do as well. But lemongrass is one of those things where you're just after the actual stock. So it really doesn't matter how it really looks like. So mm-hmm. you can use it year round.
When you plant it, it comes out of the ground in the exact same shape as it appears on your table. It doesn't have like side leaves or anything.
What you guys see on the table is not what it looks like actually at the farm. There's a lot of cleanup for lemongrass. Basically, it looks like a big bush of corn leaves or something. Mm-hmm. And we pretty much have to trim all that down, and we just really just use the stalk. And a lot of times, if we don't cut it, we can just let it sit. It can sit in there for multiple years, and we can cut it as we need it.
Okay, and then once you cut it, then you have to start all over again and plant one more stalk and then let that grow?
Yeah, but lemongrass is one of those things where when we cut it, we actually put one right back in and we leave it alone and it just gets ready for next time.
Oh, so of the ones you cut, you take one and just stick it right back in the ground?
Yeah, just like a lot of the stuff we do, sweet potatoes, you can do them that way.
So like one for the table, one for the seed, one for the table, one for the seed, sort of.
Yeah, like kind of like when I dig galanga, we have galanga in a hothouse. When I dig one of the plants out, I always take one piece and put it right back where I dug it and just cover it up and kind of forget about it, and it grows back later.
Is that sort of a traditional farming method, or is that something you figured out yourself?
I'm pretty sure everybody would do that, just because lemongrass is one of those things that takes so long to be ready mm-hmm. to where we have like a designated area for it where it's always there. It's not one of those crops that we turn over quickly.
And you have a crate here today, and it looks like it's pretty big. How many crates a week are you able to bring in?
Oh, we don't. Lemongrass is one of those things where you don't need very much of for your cooking. So we, like the way we sell them here, we sell them by a bunch. You get like one or two pieces in a bunch, and that would last the common person a pretty long time. And you won't use the whole stock. Most people just throw them in the freezer. whenever you're ready to use it, bring it back out and just grate it, and you have almost the same flavor.
Excellent. Okay, Kong, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
That was Kong Tao. He's the owner and head farmer at Tao Family Farm out of Fresno. He's at the Saturday downtown market, and he will have lemongrass year-round. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
In a moment, Andy Ricker of Pok Pok fame. We're talking about an entire genre of Thai food that goes well with an ice-cold beer, or maybe something stronger.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. This week, we've been talking all about the food of Thailand.
It's really, really hot, sour, and pungent. And those tend to be very, very popular with drinkers because it's spicy and it really hits the back of your throat.
That's Andy Ricker. For more than a decade, Andy's been a leading advocate for Northern Thai cuisine here in the States. In 2005, he opened Pok Pok in Portland, which spawned multiple locations and a cookbook. Now Andy and co-writer J.J. Good are back with a new cookbook called The Drinking Food of Thailand. True to form, it celebrates a genre of Thai food largely unknown to most Westerners. So let's first start with the beverage. When you talk about drinking in Thailand that's accompanied by snacks, what is the drink mostly that's being consumed?
Well, historically, Thailand's been a rice whiskey or rice liquor country because that was the raw material that was available. And some form of alcoholic beverage made from rice has probably been made since people figured out how to harvest rice. Basically, it's just, you know, it's rice that's been fermented with some sort of yeast, and that creates like a wine called sato, and then it gets distilled into rice whiskey. So that's the basic original drink there. There's also what we call the government whiskeys, which tend to be part rice, part sugarcane, weird colorings and stuff, and not super tasty. And then there's beer, which was introduced as an import quite some time ago and has now become very popular.
And establishments where one drinks and can also eat, describe what they are and maybe describe your first experience of them.
It's important to say that drinking happens almost anywhere, and whenever there's drinking, there's eating. So it could be anywhere from if you're a rich person, maybe a golf club. If you're a farmer, maybe just a little shack on the side of the road next to a field. If you're living in the city, maybe it's like a bona fide bar. So it really kind of depends on where you are, what social strata you're in. For me, some of the first experiences I had were in the south of Thailand, where I arrived first as a backpacker. And I relate a story in the book about being on a bus from the south up to Bangkok. I had torn a contact lens or something, and my prescription wasn't available down in Champon. So I got on the local bus all the way up to Bangkok, and there were some fishermen on the bus who were heading up to Bangkok, probably to get contact lenses also. They offered me some Mekong whiskey, which is some of the government whiskey, with a energy drink, which, you know, this is the precursor to vodka and Red Bull. This is about 1986, something like that. I was the only white guy on the bus, and they wanted to talk with me, and that, you know, they're sitting in the seat and just kind of pouring little drinks of whiskey and shots of the Lipo Itan. And that was really my first experience with a social situation where drinking was kind of the medium for people to break ice.
And so let's talk about food. When we're at a bar and we're thinking about drinking and snacking, we're reaching for peanuts and pretzels, and sometimes the peanuts are in the shell, so we're doing something too. We're like ripping the shells off. What would be the equivalent of that kind of eating?
You know, if you go to just like a Lao Khao or Lao Dong is a rice whiskey that has herbs or rhizomes or little animals in it, and they're considered medicinal. So you usually drink it like in a little shot. And one of the things you might find on the table next to the gong or the little shot glass or cup is you might have some tamarind pods. So you'd break the tamarind pot open, get the sour pulp out of the middle, and pull the little strings off the outside of the meat of the tamarind and eat it like that. Or you might find boiled peanuts. So you might literally find the same thing you would find here.
So interesting. So let's start with a dish that's more foodie called Drunkard's Stir Fry, since, you know, the title is there.
Mm-hmm. Pad Khi Mao, which literally means, as you said, the drunkard stir fry. Here in America, I remember, you know, years ago seeing Pad Khi Mao on the menu at the local Thai restaurant. And it was a noodle dish that was kind of saucy and had vegetables and was kind of spicy, basil and stuff like that. And, you know, because of the name, of course, I wanted to, you know, when I set out to write this book, I wanted to know more about the dish itself. I went to some places that made it. It's not a dish that's that easy to find, to be honest with you, you know, outside of the context of a noodle dish in Thailand as well. But I found a place, this fantastic restaurant called Rangapao Samrap Khon Chopkin Pet.
That's a name.
Yeah, it's a long name. It means hot basil restaurant for people who like to eat spicy food.
I love that name.
Yeah, it's amazing. And the lady there, Metu, she's been making this dish for quite some time. And I said, well, how did you find out about it? She says, well, I learned from somebody. That was about as far as I got. And I said, why do you think that this dish is so popular? And she said, well, because Thai people like it. And I said, why do they like it? And she said, because it's spicy. That's as far as we could get with the research.
Another thing that we tend to think of when we think about eating while drinking or eating after having drunk too much is fatty food. I think about okie dog or, you know, like super messy, super fatty, tons of flavor food. Because so much food in Thailand relies on pork. Give me some highlights that would sort of bring in this fatty aspect.
Right, so pork belly is probably one of people's favorite things to eat there. And there's obviously lots of different ways to prepare it, but one of the most common ways you find it in context of drinking would be a deep-fried pork belly. So they might roast it over a grill for a long time and then slice it up and throw it in the deep fryer. So you get this crispy, fatty dish. Another one would be jinsom mokkai, which is sour pork. But it's got lots and lots of pork back fat with the skin on it that's been sliced up. I'd say that there's probably about half pork shoulder, which is kind of fatty to start with, and then the other half is this very thinly sliced strips of pork back fat and skin and all mixed together and then fermented with rice inside a banana leaf. It's very, very sour. And that's real fatty and unctuous and delicious.
It's interesting because you think about other cuisines which also feature similar things like chicharrones, for example.
Yeah, it's the same. I mean, they make that in Thailand too called kap mu. We have a recipe for it in the book. And it's usually eaten along with nem prik or chili dip of some sort. And that's also very, very common drinking food there.
One of the things in your previous book that you had a lot of were salads. And it's interesting to me because this book also has a lot of salads. And I think that if you were to ask a Westerner, name your favorite five foods to accompany drinking, nobody would say salad.
Right. So when we say salad in Thai, the word is yum, and that means to mix. And when Westerners say salad, they're picturing like an Italian chopped salad or, you know, spinach salad or an arugula salad. It's not the same thing, really. Usually it has a bunch of things, you know, there's a base dressing, and I think that's the easiest way to kind of like equate it to a salad. A typical yum, which is a central Thai dish, would have fish sauce, lime juice, palm sugar, chilies, maybe some garlic, and that's the basis for the dish, and different ratios of those ingredients to make it hotter, more sour, more salty. And then you have like either some vegetables, maybe mushrooms, or maybe some seafood, like crab or squid, maybe some kind of noodle. And you mix it all together, and it's really, really hot, sour, and pungent. And those tend to be very, very popular with drinkers because it's spicy and it really, really hits the back of your throat.
So is there a super ubiquitous modern bar snack?
There's a few. I'd say probably one of the most ubiquitous one is called Ngai Tot, which means chicken tendons. It's like chicken kneecaps that are deep fried in a little bit of a batter. And you find that pretty much anywhere you go. But there's one that's kind of surprising that you find at almost any place. And guess what it's called?
What?
Fenfai.
French fries.
French fries. French fries are probably the most ubiquitous drinking snack there is. I've yet to go to a bar that had a kitchen that didn't make French fries.
And what's the dip?
The dip is ketchup.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Or sometimes they call sauce prick, which means chili sauce. So it's kind of like a sweet, sweet, sweet sriracha.
So since you're not here anymore, since the unfortunate closure, if we want to eat this kind of food, who do you think is making the closest to how your platonic ideal is?
I got a lot of love for my good friend Chris Yenbomrung at Night Market. And I think, you know, the spirit at which he goes at things is similar to, and certainly a lot of the dishes that he does, you know, there's some parallels there. He has a different approach to it than I do. But, you know, I think that's probably your best bet. There's obviously a great Thai food scene in L.A. And I think that by searching around for the restaurants that specialize in, you know, whatever dish it is that you're looking for, you can find a lot of stuff that's very similar to what we did, you know, and in often cases much better than we did.
That's Andy Ricker of Pak Pak. We've been talking about his new book with J.J. Good, The Drinking Food of Thailand. Now we take a quick break from Thai food. Here's resident food critic Jonathan Gold with a new restaurant review.
We are going downtown to the restaurant in the newish Freehand LA Hotel. And the restaurant is called The Exchange.
And who's the chef?
The chef is Alex Chang, who's basically a California guy with a Mexican mother and a Chinese dad. So, of course, it's an Israeli restaurant.
I love LA in this moment. It's so awesome.
It works pretty well, doesn't it?
Give us an idea of what we'll find on the menus. I know it's in a hotel, so they're open breakfast, lunch, dinner, right?
Right. It's an Israeli restaurant, but it's probably more like a restaurant that you would find in Tel Aviv than it is something that serves absolutely kosher up and down. So in the part of the menu that's labeled salatim, which I'm gathering is Hebrew for salads or kind of the equivalent of meza in like Lebanese restaurants, you'll have grated tomato, which strangely is good out of season, on top of a layer of tahini. And there's some basil, which works with tomato, obviously, a little olive oil, and then underneath is hummus. So it's a hummusy thing with sort of a tart tomato basil layer.
Sounds like an Israeli dip, like a several-layer dip.
Yeah, you could bring it to your next Super Bowl party. I mean, they make their hummus with Rancho Gordo chickpeas because,
nice,
of course, they do. There's a really nice dish of braised radishes with a little pomegranate molasses and nigella seeds. There's a dish of smashed cucumber with sesame chili oil and fennel, which on one hand might lean towards an Arabic salad, on the other hand, kind of what you have before the scallion pancakes at a Shandong-style
restaurant. Yeah, I was going to say it sounds like an Israeli take on an Asian salad.
And one of my favorite things is this tiny plate of diced avocado with herbs and toasted seeds, different seeds, that I've always ended up reordering at dinner, which I never do.
Wow.
As dips on the table, they have a house-made chili sauce that's decent, and maybe my favorite version in town at the moment of jug. It's something that I had never heard of 2 years ago, and now it seems to be on every single menu in town.
Yeah, jug and amba.
Yeah, they have amba too, though you will be amused to know that the way they serve it is in the mayonnaise that they serve with the shoestring fries. And I'm willing to state right here and now on your show that amba aioli is a new Thousand Island dressing.
Really?
You heard it here first.
Give us an idea of things beyond salatim.
My favorite dish will probably surprise you, which is a sweet potato that has been grilled until the skin is black and crisp and falling off, that's served with sort of pounded almonds and cilantro. It becomes sort of a meaty dish. It's the way you'd expect like a steak to be served, except they're doing it with a sweet potato, and I think that's really nice.
Man, how you have changed.
You say that every time I say I like a vegetable.
In a moment, we close our show by looking at how Thai food came to the U.S., especially here in Los Angeles. That's after the break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Thai food is now so ubiquitous in American food culture that it seems like it's always been here. But how did it make that long journey across the Pacific?
There were a number of reasons why Thais opened restaurants. It was economically viable, and that's how Americans kind of knew Thai people.
Mark Padungpat is an assistant professor of Asian and Asian American Studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. His new book is Flavors of Empire, Food and the Making of Thai America. Padungpat traces the history of Thai immigration to the States. Spoiler, food plays a huge role, especially here in L.A. What's your relationship to L.A.? Why did you choose to write your book about Thai food sort of centered in L.A.?
Thank you for that question. I was born and raised in Los Angeles. My parents immigrated from Thailand in the 1970s, and I actually grew up in Pacoima, in the working class suburb of Pacoima in the East San Fernando Valley. Mostly working class Latino immigrants, majority Mexican, some Guatemalans, some El Salvadorians. I lived a 5-minute drive away from the Thai temple, the Wat Thai of Los Angeles in North Hollywood. And so I grew up Thai American among other immigrant populations. And food for me, you know, I've always kind of had an ambivalent relationship to food. The funny thing is I didn't even want to write a book about food. I felt like, for one, I was always being defined by food. When I would meet people and they would discover that I was Thai, you know, one of the first things I would get is, oh, I love pad Thai. And that was the only way they kind of knew of Thai people. But I felt like we were also just kind of invisible everywhere else. And, you know, the other reason I decided to write about food is because I really felt like, you know, especially once I got to college at the University of Oregon, felt like food had become a stand-in for Thai people.
That's so fascinating because we hear over and over again how food is this window into cultures. And in your experience, what you're saying is that it basically erased. It erased you. So fascinating. So let's go back kind of historically. In your book, you talk about how America's love affair with Thai cuisine actually began during the Cold War.
Correct. You know, typically when we think about Asian immigrant food cultures in the United States is when that particular group steps foot on U.S. soil. But I thought it was really important to kind of pull back and look at the role that the United States played in Southeast Asia immediately after World War II. You know, the United States, fearing the spread of communism in Asia and Southeast Asia, particularly Vietnam, the United States really intervenes heavily in Thailand from the late 1950s to the early 1970s, right after the Vietnam War. And part of what they wanted to do is just establish a strategic base in Thailand, establish military bases to, you know, try to thwart off the communist influence in the area. And what the United States tried to do after World War II was really win hearts and minds around the world. So they viewed Asia and Asian peoples and cultures more positively than they had before, right? We were just coming out of a World War II with internment of Japanese Americans. But immediately afterwards, because of foreign policy objectives, the United States starts to imagine Asia and the Pacific as, you know, people who could potentially be Americans if they were just guided and modernized and developed. And so the United States establishes cultural exchange programs in Thailand. The Southeast Asian Treaty Organization headquarters is established in Bangkok. There's a number of programs, the U.S. Peace Corps, the Fulbright, private organizations teaching English get established in Thailand. So all of these relationships and connections and policies lead to everyday interactions between what I, you know, call kind of ordinary U.S. citizens, people who aren't diplomats or state officials or military officials, but just everyday people who are traveling to Thailand. And that's where they discover Thai food for the first time.
So this is so interesting. So amongst all of these organized exchange programs were culinary tours.
Yes, yes.
So you're saying that basically regular American people got sort of seduced to Thai culture through culinary tours, and they jump-started the knowledge of Thai food in America before there was even Thai immigration?
Yes, that's correct. I'll give you a specific example. So Marie Wilson was the first to publish a Thai cookbook in the United States. In 1965, she publishes a book called Siamese Cookery. And Siamese was the name used to refer to Thai people. You know, Thailand was formerly known as Siam before the 1930s when they changed the name to Thailand. And so she writes the first Thai cookbook in the United States and publishes it in 1965. And because of the 1965 Immigration Act, this is right at that same time, from 1924 to 1965, Thais couldn't enter the United States because of U.S. immigration policies. And so there weren't a lot of Thais, and the Thais who were in the United States were largely students who had the wherewithal and to come and study in the United States. And so women like Marie Wilson, there's Jennifer Brennan, Maida Khroizat, they're traveling in Thailand during the 50s and 60s because of this relationship the United States has with Thailand. They collect recipes. They bring those recipes home, sometimes publish them in cookbooks. You know,
and this is before the opening of like the famed LA market, Bangkok market.
Yes, yes.
So these recipes were bastardized.
You can say that. I think I was less interested in whether or not the food that they were making was authentic, because I understood that they didn't have the ingredients available to them in Los Angeles. And so they really had to, you know, be somewhat creative, sometimes missing the mark. And I think Marie Wilson, one of her recipes for gang kung shrimp curry, it's a red curry that uses curry paste and also coconut milk as its base. I think she used sour cream and cayenne pepper to try to replicate this flavor.
So you say that this kind of culinary tourism created an idealized portrait of mm-hmm. Thai people and Thailand in the American imagination.
Yes. I like to think about it as a Disney-fied version, in the sense that, you know, in order to make their cookbooks and to make Thai food and to open up these more positive kind of relationships to Thai people and Thai culture, you know, suburban women like Marie Wilson, they painted a very romanticized image of Thailand as this kind of exotic kingdom where different kinds of people, so they acknowledged that Thailand had different kind of people, Chinese, Indians, groups from different religious backgrounds, and they framed and painted a picture of Thai people as living kind of harmoniously together despite their differences. And that Thai food, because it borrowed from all of these different cultural influences, really reflected that Thailand was a country that brought together diverse groups of people harmoniously. And it just wasn't the case, because there had been virulent anti-Chinese sentiment in Thailand in the 30s that extended into the 50s.
Also, I think one has to mention the giant musical, The King and I, which was most Americans' sort of entree into the fact that there was this land. So let's come closer to today. Let's talk about Thai immigration to L.A. When did Thais begin arriving in L.A. in numbers? What were some of the reasons for coming?
Thais are coming in large numbers in the mid-1960s, and the first wave is made up mostly of Thai students who were from, you know, middle-class backgrounds from urban areas, specifically Bangkok. So Thai students were coming. They were coming on student visas, right, coming to study in the United States. And then by the late 1970s, they started overstaying those visas.
So here in L.A., there's this huge Thai restaurant boom that starts in the 1970s and in the 1980s, especially on the city's west side. In 1975, one-third of all Thai businesses in L.A. were restaurants. So what factors steered these immigrants who came or overstayed their visas into the restaurant business?
It was just one of the more viable economic opportunities open to them. They didn't have language skills. You know, there's a range of reasons, both structural and individual. But I think one key factor here as well is that there was a group of Thais who had already made some headway in the food industry in Los Angeles, opening up restaurants. And they then kind of reached out to other Thais who came over and immigrated and then helped them open up restaurants as well.
Your book also talks about how Thai Americans attempt to build a really robust community, including the establishment of Thai Town. What kind of challenges did they face initially on creating these aspects of community that are now so deeply embedded?
You know, Thai Town is in an urban area. They had a much easier time appealing to city officials to kind of get the neighborhood between, you know, Hollywood Boulevard, between Western and Normandy, marked off as Thai Town. But in the suburbs in the 1980s, Thais had a really difficult time, mainly because, you know, when Thai immigrants moved next to the Thai temple and had food festivals to build community and use it as a community space, their idea of living in the suburbs was that the home wasn't the center of suburban life. It was the temple. But for residents in that neighborhood, you know, they held on to that idea of 1950s suburban ideal, where the home was the center of life. Tree-lined streets, plentiful parking, quiet neighborhoods. Thai immigrants living there and trying to build community around food festivals, that vision of suburban life clashed with the existing visions. And so they had to deal with specifically zoning laws.
There's an interesting passage I'm wondering if you could read from page 188.
All right. So unlike white chefs, chefs of color do not have unbridled freedom to serve street style or authentic dishes with obscure ingredients for U.S. consumers because their food is, as it always has been, associated with their bodies.
Do you feel like that's changing?
It's hard to say because I know a couple of Thai chefs now who are making the turn towards Thai street food. The reason I wrote that is because I wanted us to really think about the historical relationship that America has had with Asian and Asian food and ethnic food, German, Italian, throughout history. I think we're at a moment when we're going to see some Thai chefs try to make that leap into serving street-style food because it has become a little bit more popular now. You know, I think Anthony Bourdain and David Chang and a number of other kind of popular food figures are really starting to unpack the complexity of food cultures, and specifically Asian and Asian American food cultures. We tend to think about food as something that's just, you know, seemingly insignificant. It's why should we care about food? There are a lot of other issues related to kind of race and marginalization and racism that we can focus on. But I think food can be a very powerful site of disruption in that way. And I think that we're starting to see some of that shift.
I've been talking to Mark Poddingpott, Assistant Professor of Asian and Asian American Studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. His book is called Flavors of Empire, Food and the Making of Thai America. Thank you so much for listening to our show this week, all about the food of Thailand. If you missed any part of it, you can listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Find us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review if you like the show. Subscribe to our podcast and you'll get a bonus episode on Monday featuring highlights from the recent Food Book Fair in Los Angeles, including a panel discussion I was on about the future of food media. Many thanks to the Good Food team. I am Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.